Cindy Hale is with me on the phone from Clover Valley Farms. Cindy has been on KTWH before and has quite a presence in our community. So thank you so much, Cindy, for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah. So I got to say, first of all, that I think you are best currently known for your vinegars.
Okay.
And we have other things to talk about. But before we do that, I want you to just share a little bit about what vinegars you have going at the farmer's market right now. And I mean, those things are pretty gourmet and special, I think, and worthy of a bit of a little shout out.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, most people don't know the story behind vinegars.
Right.
So what makes our vinegars really unique is that we literally make them from scratch. So we grow the fruit gets turned into a wine, and then we add a bacterial culture to that wine that turns it into vinegar. And so it's not uncommon at a farmer's market where somebody will say, oh, these vinegars look really good. What kind of vinegar do you use? Like, they don't even get that. No, we're making the vinegar.
Right.
Like, we're growing it. It's a biological process. And they're like, what? No way. And then, you know, that really, it puts it in a very different perspective.
Yeah.
You know, and then. Yeah, and they, you know, in my not-so-humble opinion, they really taste good. So we do a rhubarb vinegar, a juneberry currant, wild cherry, apple. We have a plum vinegar right now that's going really nicely. And then we'll sell the, you know, the straight vinegar, but then we'll also do herb infusions. So, like, there's a garlic-infused plum vinegar that's just crazy good. And the juneberry currant you can get with sage or red chili or basil. And then we also use our vinegars to make a product called shrubs, which is basically a blend of some kind of vinegar and a fruit or honey syrup. So there, it's a concentrate that's sweet and tangy. People use them to make sparkling sodas, cocktails, marinades, dressings, all kinds of stuff. And yeah, you can get them and try them at the Two Harbors and the Duluth Farm Market.
Awesome. I think part of it is a change of mentality about vinegar, because just a few drops of one of those vinegars on top of a meal, oh man, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit goes a long way.
A little bit goes a
long
way.
And it ain't no white distilled vinegar, I tell you.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on. Cindy, you have long been involved in just local food movement and in general ecological resilience. I remember you speaking about how years ago you noticed that the ground where your chickens lived tended to be healthier, and led to sort of a foreshadow of the whole movement about ruminants and how good it is for animals to trample on ground. And at least that's where I remember.
Yeah.
And recently
restorative agriculture before it.
Thank you. That's the term I was looking for. And, now we have a situation where there's a sort of a new discussion in different directions people are going. Everyone knows that food prices have gone way up, that we have a lot of instability around national relations, global relations, and also around our ecological systems with the sort of instability of climate change. And I know I've heard in different places things like we need to feed the world, and that can mean a lot of different things to different people. For some, it seems to mean we need to increase our production of corn and soy and wheat. And I think you have a little bit of a different take on it. Do you want to just share with us some of what you're thinking and what has been discussed and researched in the areas you know about this?
Well, I think that the whole conversation about, especially with, like, you know, the issue in Ukraine. Ukraine currently grows, what is it, 40% of the world's wheat?
Right.
I mean, how dumb is that? I mean, how vulnerable is that? I mean, even before Russia invaded them, if you think about it for about 10 seconds, it's like, yeah. You know, my grandmother always said, your grandma probably did too, don't put your eggs in all in one basket.
Right.
And that's really, you know, when we talk about we need to feed the world. Well, who is we?
Right.
First of all, we, more often than not, whether it's explicitly stated or not, implies corporate ag. So right now, there's 3 to 5 companies, global mega companies, that control the whole world's food population. Well, if they can control our food, then they have power. They can control us. So what's the best way to you know, it's just like energy. You know, you put up a solar panel on your house, suddenly you're not beholden to the power company. You have a little bit more security. And food security is exactly the same thing. I mean, if we grew more of our own food, and people who are eaters, which is everyone,
yep,
had a little bit more understanding of what is the process of growing food. And I'll even go further. What is food? So when we talk about food, if you go to the grocery store and you walk up and down the aisles, the vast majority of the ingredients are one of a handful of products. It's wheat, corn, soy.
That's kind of it.
Yeah. Katya? Yeah. Wheat, corn, soy. Well, those aren't the only food crops on the planet. My God. I can walk outside my yard right now, and I am surrounded by food. Surrounded by food. And not necessarily just the stuff that I'm actively cultivating, you know, like the cucumbers and the zucchinis and the tomatoes and the squash and all that wonderful stuff. There is so much food out there.
Yeah. You know?
Just think of wild foraging. So lamb's quarter, it's also called wild spinach, dandelion greens, plantain leaves. There's innumerable wild plants / weeds that are not only edible, but they're delicious and they're full of nutrients, minerals, and things that you actually don't get. And there's a lot of research that shows that locally grown and harvested food, it's good for your economy because, you know, it's good for food security, but it's also much more nutrient dense. The stuff that's grown thousands of miles away or halfway across the world just doesn't have much nutrient in it. So you're basically eating a little bit of flavored cardboard. And so if what people really want is security, which everybody does, right? We all want to feel like our lives are safe, our bodies are safe, our families are safe. Becoming more aware of what food is, where I can get it for free, how I can grow it, or supporting local farmers to grow it for me. I mean, it's as close as you can come to a magic bullet in my not-so-humble
opinion. Right. I mean, because it also feeds the soil, which sequesters the carbon, and it is. There are many solutions tied up in this.
The first argument always is, well, we can't grow enough food to support our population. And that's just simply not true. There's actually a study that was done back in 2005 that looked at historically, especially northeastern Minnesota is a really great kind of micro example, micro ecosystem. Because when Duluth started, you know, it was timber, shipping, iron, right? And those extractive industries required an immense number of bodies. And there wasn't a big world corporate ag that we could ship food in. So, you know, the people who wanted to have those employees, the leaders, as it were, of the timber and iron ore, what did they do? They started farms. They built farms that fed their population. And most of northern Minnesota was completely self-sufficient. In fact, northern Minnesota was the leading exporter of potatoes right up until the 1970s. We were growing more food and a huge diversity of food. We were growing more of it than we needed, and we were exporting it.
So anybody who
says northern Minnesota can't grow enough food to feed themselves just has no concept of history, and you're not thinking creatively enough.
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting, because I think when we do think about feeding ourselves, I tend to go back farther to the more indigenous times where wild rice, berries, venison, you know, that was a whole level as well. But I think it would be helpful, as you said, to look into the early industrial era, because that might be food that people can sort of imagine themselves sustaining themselves on more. I think when you said that, the first thing I thought of was a black and white photo, I think it's in the county courthouse, of a logging camp and the butchery of the kitchen. There were like four pigs hanging, you know, and I think that's what you're saying. Like, those pigs grew up right in the northern Minnesota woods, and that would be really interesting.
I mean, I think your observation too of, you know, there were millions of Native people living here just fine before we came here and living a very healthy, ecologically balanced lifestyle, so we can hearken back to that. But like you said, that might feel very foreign or kind of scary to people who have grown up in kind of this Western food culture. But yeah, you don't have to give up the things you're comfortable with. You might have to give up eating strawberries in January.
Well, but we do have a freezer. We have a freezer.
Right. There's a seasonality to food.
Right.
That my experience in just working with customers and volunteers and people who come to the farm, that when they discover this seasonality of food, because we've been trained not to think of it as food as seasonal, you can see the little light bulbs go off in their head. They're like, oh, yeah, oh, cool. And it actually makes you appreciate more what you have in any given season because, hey, I'm not going to have this all the time.
Right.
And we can and we can freeze, and so we can extend. Yeah, but you're not going to get fresh off the vine strawberries in January. And you know what? That makes the June and July strawberries just so much more succulent and delicious.
That's very true. Cindy, we're pretty much running out of time, but I want to make sure that you get some closing words. Do you have anything to add to this? I feel like I'm ready to go do a study of what they ate in the early 19th century.
Yeah. You know, I just think we all should be concerned about what's going on in the world. I mean, it's bad. It's horrific. We want to be able to do something to help these people. And we should not buy the big lines that are being perpetrated across media right now that everything is going to fall apart and we're all going to starve to death and die. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
And the reality is, well, I guess it could happen, but it's not going to happen if we choose to do simple things like use less energy, grow some food, share what you have with others. I mean, it's the same thing that you're taught in kindergarten, right?
Right. And let's finish with the farmer. Yeah. And the farmer's market, I always come back to that because we're going to need some level of food system, you know, and successful farmers if we are to sort of lean more heavily on them and put the weight on that. And so more successful farmers we have now, the better we're going to be as these prices rise and as crises or maybe just harder times come on all of us. So thank you, Cindy. Go ahead.
Yeah, it might not even be a crisis. It might just be a shift in what we eat and how we eat.
Exactly.
It doesn't have to be a crisis.
Right. Good point. All right. Thank you, Cindy. We'll have you again.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That was Cindy Hale. She is one of the owners of Clover Valley Farms near here and certainly a visionary.